Session number 15474, Reel 2.
The John's Reel 2.
Yes, this Yonkers 88 made several runs over the East, but lo and behold, to our amazement, I almost say pleasure, the thing came right towards us where we had rigged up a Bren gun on anti-aircraft mounting. And it was near enough and low enough for us to actually see the crew. It was our first close view of an enemy plane. And we had a go at it. We had a shot at it. Whether we hit it or not, I don't know. But we were delighted to think that we must have been one of the few people that had a shot in real anger at an enemy aircraft with a Bren gun and in this country.
What damage did it do to Eastbourne?
Well, I think there were a few houses that were destroyed, but there was no strategic damage or anything like that. It was purely a nuisance raid.
Do you know which part of Eastbourne it hit?
No, I don't. No.
Any other attacks you remember?
No. No.
Or any other incidents from those days?
No.
Were the local population much inconvenienced by the coastal defences?
The local population were rare because, you see, most of the property around there had been evacuated. Indeed, our men on the guns on the beach were in holiday bungalows still furnished. And so there was very little, except until Eastbourne itself had quite a lot of people. There were dances and cinemas and things like that going on in Bexhill. The Delaware Pavilion at Bexhill was a lovely rendezvous for youngsters with dancing ambitions. But there again, the beaches were completely out of bounds with barbed wire and anti-tank landing obstacles.
How was public morale like regarding the war by this time?
Oh, stoic, I would say. There was this attitude of being certain that we would win, and that I think the more that the bombings went on, the more that attitude perpetuated.
And you had another a period of exercises then in Hampshire?
Yes, we went then for a short spell to Aldershot. This was an education to a unit like ours, which really was a unit of civilians, more or less, to go to a place like Aldershot, the home of the British Army, and see the discipline and the regularity. Indeed, to sleep on a bed, an army bed in a barracks, was a novelty to us then. But we weren't there for that. We were there because it was handy for Hampshire, where we carried out a lot of intensive exercises with division size exercises, really, really big coordinated exercises.
Do you think the exercise was much use to you?
Well, I'm sure they were, yes. Yes, because here we were with units of some calibre, and it didn't fail to rub off on us, and it gave us a certain amount of pride, too, to be with other units. It was mainly the 55th Lancashire Division.
Now, I think you then had another spell of coastal defence in the autumn.
That's right. We went almost to Pevensey Bay, just inland from Pevensey Bay, at a little village called Hurstmansoo. And when I refer to war being a pleasure to us. I mean, you must understand that we were terribly frustrated because the things were happening everywhere. People were going out to the Far East, people were going out to the Middle East, and here we were doing nothing else but enjoy ourselves, subject to a training and guard duties. Hurstman Sioux was one of those places where we had a really easy time, and we were lucky enough to be within walking distance of Hurstman Sioux Castle, which, as you probably know, was the observatory until recently. It's recently been sold again, I think. But evacuated into Hurstman Sioux Castle was the Hearts of Oak Insurance Company. And this meant that there were hordes of young unmarried girls at half a mile distance from where we were in the village. And yes, there was quite a lot of romantic associations accrued from that spell there. But they were very good, actually. I mean, they were cognizant, really, of the fact that, yes, we might be enjoying ourselves at the time. They had much more money than we had. And they were, I think the word is hospitable. It sounds silly when we're both away from home. But they were very generous to us. And when we said, well, you know, we are just as safe as you are here while we're here, they said, yes, but your turn is still to come. And that was rather nice.
I think you spent some time in Hull.
Yes.
Why did you go there?
Well, after Hurstman Sioux, we went back to the Cotswolds, so near Morton in Marsh. I always associate the Cotswolds with winter and snow and ice, and we were there. We were put into an estate of nearly finished houses. And my memory is of builder's rubble and mud and general discomfort, except for one extraordinary thing, which has always been something I've been rather proud of. They didn't know what to do with us, and at the same time, the farming community, never mind they had land girls and that, they were always glad of help. So somebody at last decided that we could be of some use to the community by agricultural assistance. And they used to take us out in trucks every day to farms in the Cotswolds. Never the same farm would you go through twice. What would happen is, it seems, that the farmers would put in to some central place what sort of labour force they'd want for that day and for what task, whether it was picking up potatoes or cutting beet and loading beet or just hoeing. And someone centrally would coordinate this and send us off each day, which was fine. And they weren't supposed to pay us because this was all supposed to be reciprocal. But some of them did. And all of them supplied free cider at lunchtime. And so it was a nice diversion, even if sometimes you did get soaking wet. But you did feel you were doing something useful. And when that spell was over, oh, incidentally, I should say, before we left there, something happened there which affected my friendships. I joined up with certain people and hoping to stay together, as you do. But the RAF had been calling for volunteers from the army because the air crews had been sadly depleted by the Battle of Britain, and the bombing production was going, I was going to say like a bomb, but was going very well. And they were short of crews, and they made an appeal right through the services, and in the hopes of getting some action, we all volunteered. Now, all of my friends were accepted, except myself, and this was on purely educational grounds. I had no, I mentioned earlier, I had no secondary education at all. And so, I suppose rightly, they decided I would never make a navigator and that sort of thing. So they, I lost really all my friends while we were at Morton in Marsh. And I became more and more determined than ever to try to get overseas one way or another. But from that point, we were moved up to Hull. I kept renewing my applications for service overseas. And it was in May of 42 that I actually, while we were at Hull, that I actually, with two other friends, managed to get a transfer to a unit which was going overseas to the Middle East. And,
where were you based in Hull?
In two villages. First of all, in Hedden, and then secondly, a mile or two away from there, in the village of Preston. And I must say, they were extremely enjoyable. Well, Hedden, not, but we were only there for Christmas. But Preston was marvellous. This was village life at its best, with the population so kind, and the church, the whole community so helpful, that it really was a most enjoyable time. And you must remember that Hull was being bombed quite a bit by then, at that time. But we still had regular trucks into Hull for dances and cinemas and things like that. But it was a very enjoyable time. But even, see, that made your conscience even more guilty, that why should we be enjoying ourselves when the war is going on, and that's what we're here for, and the people who are suffering are not the soldiers. It's the civilians, you know, that it just seemed anomalous, and so I did very much want to get away, and hope that whether it was in the Far East or the Near East, I'd get some action.
Had you not?
Can I just mention one thing that I forgot, and that's when the second spell in the Cotswolds, the raid on Coventry took place. And this was a real signal point in my attitude to the war, really, because it seemed that while we were at Suffolk, we could see and hear London being bombed and London on fire. You could actually feel, you know, though it was 80 miles away, the tremors of the bombs and everything. And all these civilians were being killed, and we were safe and comfortable there. We move across the country to Banbury, or near Banbury. And the very night that we get there, or the next night, we see the same thing happening to Coventry. And this was galling to people who had joined the forces to fight, to think that all the people that were suffering were the civilians.
You felt the tremor of bombs in London 80 miles away?
Yes, yeah.
In Felixstowe?
Yes. And you'd hand over. If you go on your guard duty, you would hand over and they'd say, are they still at it? Yes, they're still at it. And you could look and see the red sky. Yes, terrible.
Coming back to Hull.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, I did die.
You said that about the hospitality there. Were you not used to northern hospitality coming from Liverpool?
I can honestly say that we had good hospitality everywhere, but in Preston, in Hull, we were almost villagers. We were strangers in their midst. without any question at all about what we were as persons. And this was so extraordinary. And the other thing about it, of course, we were right in the village, in Nissenhut, right in the village. Nothing could go on in the village without we were involved in every way. Really, it was very pleasant.
What did you see of the devastation in Hull?
Oh, Hull was very badly damaged in central Hull. You would go through... We were taken into Hull for baths. It was the only place where we'd go from baths. And you would see street after street of devastation. Then you'd see the remains of a cinema. It was all around. It was like going home on leave to Liverpool, seeing the same sort of scenes.
What did public morale seem to be like in Hull?
I don't think it was any different from anywhere else. I don't think that anybody says... I never heard anyone say, I can't stand any more of this. You know, it's something that we've got to stick out.
Which baths did you go to in Hull?
I can't remember now whether it was Holderness Road or Beverly Road, but one or both of them were converted... The swimming part of them were converted for ballroom dancing, you know, and I used to go to Beverly Road baths for dancing, and dancing in the barracks, which was called Wenlock Barracks, I think. Wenlock, yeah. Mm.
Any more memories from Hull?
Not really.
Could you tell me about going overseas now, please?
Mm. We were suddenly told that our application for overseas service had been granted, and we were being posted to a unit at Newcastle, which was eminently overseas bound, and that we might not even get embarkation leave. And within 24 hours, we're on our way to Newcastle. And it is true that all of the unit there, and we were only making up the numbers of a unit to go overseas, which was the 95th Anti-Tank Regiment. 102, that's where you're, 95th Anti-Tank Regiment. They'd all had their 14 days embarkation leave, and there was only time for us to have about 8 days. And we were home in Liverpool. Well, by then, my friend was from Leeds. Two of us from Liverpool, and my main friend was then from Leeds. We had our embarkation leave. And we left Newcastle, I think, about the end of May, or early June, to arrive at Greenock on... I think we left about mid-June, left Greenock on a vessel called a New Zealand passenger thing called the SS Awatea. The Awatea was a magnificent new ocean-going liner, but of course by the time it's sectioned off for troop ship purposes, it is like all troop ships, terribly, terribly congested. So much so that you ate in the same area that you slept in, and there wasn't sufficient floor space for everyone to sleep on the floor, so hammocks were provided for nighttime sleeping. And it was an enlightening experience, that was, because you never thought that people could really live in such congested conditions. And as you know, you join a convoy of seemingly hundreds. I don't know how many vessels would be in this convoy which set sail from Glasgow. But the one thing I always remember about that, leaving Glasgow, as you sailed down the Clyde, all the workmen on the shipyards stopped everything to wave, and all the messages of good luck, lads, and all that sort of thing. Very moving experience. I always think it, whenever I think of it, it's I find that quite a moving experience. And then out into the Atlantic. We had one rather unusual experience on that convoy too, because you're always assuming that the protection around a convoy is going to look after you. But one morning, it wasn't quite dawn, the vessel lurched and obviously been hit, and I really thought this was it. Unmistakably been hit, and I was sure that this was going to could only be a torpedo, and we waited a few seconds of anxious silence, and sure enough the alarm bells went. It was the most awful scramble. I was in a hammock, and the most awful scramble for the gangways. And I could see no future in that. I thought, if we're going to go down, I'm going to stay here and not get involved in the scramble at the gangways. And so I think it seemed an age before there was ease for me to go up the gangway and get up and join the rest of the crew at muster stations, the rest of the units at the muster stations, in time to hear my name called for the second time. And we waited up there with life jackets on for... Oh, incidentally, I said about life jackets. I took four or five that I saw lying around. I thought, well, perhaps, you know, these lads have left in such anxiety they've forgotten about their life jackets. And I was horrified to be told off when I had to get up there, to be told off because I got more than my share of life jackets. But anyway, after a few minutes, it came over the tannoy thing that what had happened is that in the early morning mist, another ship in the convoy had hit the Arbatea. There was a gaping hole in the bows of the ship into which they poured concrete. Why they have concrete on a ship, I don't know, but... the convoy had to go on without us, and when we caught them up again at Freetown, the vessel was inspected, allowed to go on to South Africa, but it really meant that the end of the Awatea as a troop ship for us, but it gave us a bonus of, instead of the usual 2 or 3 days that people had going round the Cape, either at Cape Town or Durban, we had about 4 weeks in Durban while they found another ship for us to go up to Egypt. So it was a bit of a blessing in disguise, really.
Any other incidents on the voyage?
The only incident on the voyage that was any interest to me was I got a stripe on there. I'd been 3 years in a unit. And got no promotion at all. I'd been less than 3 months in this unit, and they gave me a stripe. We had on board, you see, we had things like quizzes and... one of my fortes was aircraft recognition. And which I thought was just useful, but a sort of hobby. But it turned out to be quite useful because I could they latched onto this, and of all the things, things physical on a troop ship are almost impossible because you haven't got the space. So anything which was of a sort of sedentary type of thing was a bonus. And they found in my aircraft recognition things of some use, and I could move around different parts of the unit giving talks on the aircraft recognition. So I felt I had some use at last.
You went.
So I got the stripe then. I got the stripe just before we arrived at South Africa. Yes.
Did you go ashore in South Africa?
Yes, we were at Durban for, as I say, it must be 3 or 4 weeks, because the Awatea couldn't go on because it was so badly damaged. They wouldn't let it go on any further. And they couldn't find a ship for us for 3 weeks. And the vessel, it was a Polish vessel, which eventually took us away, a vessel called the Kosciuszko, took us then up to Egypt. But I can't let them stay at Durban Pass without saying that that was an absolute Shangri-La of a break. I mean, most people go into ecstasies about the 2 days or the 3 days they had there, and we had 3 weeks there. And the very first night out, we were adopted, a family adopted us, and took us home, took us everywhere. In fact, it became quite competitive because their friends wanted to take us, and that we had an embarrassing situation of trying to please everybody that wanted to take us out and show us places and feed us and do our laundry. And oh yes, it was really a wonderful time. And I kept in contact with them for a long time. And 3 or 4 years ago, a friend of mine who now lives in South Africa, he went back and married a girl he met there. He located some of these people that were so kind to us, or not them, but their children, and so we're in contact again. Very nice.
Why do you think they made such a special effort?
Well, you have to remember that South Africa were fighting with us then. At that time, South African men were in the army in the desert. They were in the Air Force in the desert. And so their lads were doing their share up there, and they felt that the least they could do is to see and hope, you know, perhaps if whatever their men were going to be, someone would perhaps be as kind to them as they could. And the other thing, of course, they were terribly conscious of the fact that we had been in a war for 3 years on limited rationing, blackouts, and that all this was dreamlike, really. That the food, the abundance of everything, and the absence of shortages of any kind.
Now, what about your arrival in Egypt?
Yes, that was a bit of a chaos. We arrived at Port Tewfik. They took us out to in lorries, really onto the fringe of the desert, and it seems as though nobody knew about us, because we spent the night just bedded down on the sand. The next day, somebody came along with trucks and took us to a camp, which was a makeshift camp of a tented camp near the Sweetwater Canal, near the Suez Canal, and nearer still to the Sweetwater Canal. And we stayed there for 2 or 3 days until we moved to a permanent camp in Geneva on the canal, when things were a bit more civilized, when meal tents were available and nappies were available. And generally, they sort of sorted us out, but the